Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us for this episode. Just an editor's note before we begin. The first 50 minutes or so of this episode is a little muted because we were having some mic trouble, but stick with us at the 50-minute mark or so. Everything goes back to normal. It's a great episode with the Portuguese Prince, Ricky Lima. Enjoy the show, everybody.
To the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this very special episode, we have a returning guest, a comic book legend from Toronto. How do you guys say it?
What?
The legend?
The legion? Oh, yeah, it's like Australia or New Zealand accent. Yeah. Yo, as you're doing that intro, this kid hit his head on his railing. It's pretty great. It's pretty funny.
If you guys don't recognize the voice of our returning guest, it's the Portuguese Prince himself, Ricky Lima. Ricky, yeah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to have you back.
I'm happy to be back. It's been, what, 2 years?
Almost 2 years, man. Yeah. November 2017 was your first episode, number 99.
What? Oh, not even 100?
No.
Shane was on 100.
But you know what's funny? You were on episode 99. If you look behind you, you got a Wayne Gretzky 99 banner behind you.
All right.
There you go. How's that?
The great one.
That's right. Yeah. There you go. I like Portuguese Prince.
All right.
It has an air of royalty. All
right.
So, Ricky, how's it going?
It's good, man. For some reason, my left eye keeps tearing up. I'm just so happy to be here.
Are you gonna fall asleep on me?
No. I got a CPAP machine, man. I don't need to sleep anymore.
Help. Shane insisted that I ask you about your sleep.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what that meant, but you're sleeping well these days.
Yes. So, like, man, I don't even know. I'd say, like, probably, like, 2017, I started, like, noticing that my sleep was like that. And then Shane was like, yo, you have sleep apnea. And I was like, shh, no, I don't, whatever. And I was like, he was really pushing for it. I was like, whatever. But then eventually, like, it got so bad where I was, like, falling asleep at work and, like, dream world and real world started meshing together and like crazy stuff was happening and I was like, all right, maybe I should go check it out.
Did when you have like that moment of am I sleeping, am I awake,
yeah,
and you got like your imagination or your dreams going, did it ever inspire you to like, I should write that down, that was kind of cool?
No, because there's never like anything cool. It would be like, you know, like, oh, my boss is beside me and I look over and like no one's there, and so it was more just like crappy stuff, you know, and it wasn't anything cool. But the whole of the sleep clinic experience, I think I want to like write something about that, because that was weird. There's like, it's just weird, like, because they put all these wires on your head, and like the second time I went, one of the I guess nurse, the orderlies or something, he had this like he had his phone in his pocket that was playing like Indian drone music, and it felt like a ritual as he's like putting these things on my head. It's like playing this like drone music, and I'm like, what is happening?
You're gonna get plugged into the Matrix.
I know, right? Like, it was so weird. So, and then the doctor that was like doing the sleep clinic thing, he was really strange. Like, I don't even know if like he cared what was going on. He just seemed like he was like so aloof about everything. So I went through all that, and then I got the CPAP machine. It was basically like night and day, like from the day before I had it to the day after. Kind of like totally different. Like, I woke up the night after using it and I was really sore because I had moved all night. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I've never, my muscles are like, my joints hurt.
You would usually toss and turn like crazy before.
Exactly, yeah. Or and, like, go to the bathroom all the time. Now I don't go to the bathroom, like, ever.
So, a nice, good night's sleep. You feel brand new, like a new man.
But what sucks now is, like, so now physically I can sleep. But then it's like, you know, all the other things that keep you awake at night still, like, that doesn't get go away, you know what I mean? So, like, if you're, like, worried about something, you're, like, anxious, you're, like, you know, CPAP machine not going to help with that, you know?
No.
So right now I'm getting about, like, 5-6 hours of sleep every night. But it's, like, good sleep, so it's, like, you know, so
that's
good. Pretty good.
That's good.
Yeah. And it helps, you know? Now all I got to do is lose weight and then take over the world, you know?
Watch out.
Out.
a well rested, in shape Ricky Lima.
Oh,
who could stop that? You keep the beard though, right?
I grow bigger.
You grow. So how
now, now you don't have to hide the chin, the weak chin.
I don't think you got a weak chin.
I got a weak chin. It's like I look like a frog if I shave. You know, like frogs.
Do you have a picture of yourself without the beard?
I mean, probably, yeah.
Yeah, I want to see what this weak chin. All these people who have beards say they got a weak chin. Do I have a weak chin?
No, you got a strong chin.
Probably a glass chin if someone hit it, but. So how? What's new and exciting with you? Are you ready for Fan Expo?
Yeah. I have my new book ready to go. And so this is like the earliest I've ever had the book ready. Like I'm not scrambling around getting it done, so it's pretty good.
That's got to help with the sleep.
Yeah, there you go. I don't have to worry about that, yeah. And you read it, and it's good, I guess?
I enjoyed it. I read it twice.
Yeah, why did you read it twice? Because it's confusing?
No, because I read it yesterday after work, and as I was finishing it up, I was losing a little bit of focus because it's the end of the day,
yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that when I read your afterword about it, everything was like, okay, I know exactly where this is going. So I reread it again to catch on to the illustrations because you explained the at the beginning to the. It's the young boy who's asking about these things that are coming to get them. And you show the four panels of these robotic monsters that... Because I wasn't sure at first what those four images were, if they were like kaiju or something, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I got it. You want to give the synopsis instead of me trying to prove to you I read it?
Okay, so it's called Undergrowth, and it's about these four robots that are like invading the planet for the resources. So they're like draining the planet of the resources. And so the society is like scared of the robots. They tried fighting them, but then they couldn't really do it, so now they just kind of leave them and just stay out of their way. And then one night, these, like, three kids are out, like, watching some stars, and then they get killed by the robots. And then the Earth planet brings them back to life with these giant robots, like, organic robots, like, tree fusion robots, to fight against the invaders. And then it kind of goes from there.
So what was the inspiration for this? Where did you...
It was Gundam, the original Gundam series, and Evangelion, those two animes. So, like, I have, like, an hour-long bus ride every day. So I was just like, yo, I can just start watching, like, TV shows that I think are good or whatever. So I started watching Gundam, and I was like, man, this show is, like, it's intense, man. Like, people are, like, dying, and there's, like, so much trauma just happening all the time. And it's, like... You know, it's not a kid show at all. Like, you watch it, you're like, yeah, this stuff's crazy. It's like real war, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So then I was thinking, I was like, yeah, I'd like to do my own, like, mech comic or whatever. So I started thinking about, like, what would be cool. And I was like, oh, what about, like, trees and mechs? And then I think there's something, like, with the mech genre that's inherent with, like, trauma and stuff. Like, I don't know what it is, but, like, pretty much every mech anime or mech TV show has people like suffering from something, right? So then yeah, I was using the comic as a way to like kind of explore like how people deal with like mental health, and so then them dying is like they have to deal with that for the rest of the book, right? So, and then it just kind of came from that, and then went from there.
So in regards to like the not the metaphor, but the fact in the book that these robots, they're where are they from? They're from another planet. Is that established, or is that something we're going to find out?
Well, we'll find out, but yeah, they're from, like, another planet.
Okay, so the fact that they're sucking our resources, is this, like, a theme that, in regards to, like, what's happening in the world, the things like global warming that you're kind of thinking of?
Well, it wasn't originally, but now it is. Now that, like, because, like, you kind of develop an idea, and you're like, yeah, that's a sick idea, and you don't really think too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you start writing it, you kind of... At least for me, you see similarities, and then you're like, oh, yeah, okay. So that's, you know, this can be represent this, and then you kind of push towards that a little bit more, you know what I mean?
Do you think about that a lot? Because it kind of makes me think of, it's not the anywhere the same story, but when you did the deep sea with the sludge.
Yeah.
It was, again, the...
I think it's just like, you know, that's where my brain goes. It's places like that, you know what I mean? So, I don't know. It's definitely not something I think of when I start.
Right.
But when I'm in the middle of it, it'll come to me.
Maybe subconsciously it's
there.
Yeah,
exactly, right? So, which is good, but it's also bad, too, because then it's like you're in the middle of it, and you're like, oh, this would be sick, But then you already did some issue one that kind of like stops you from doing that. And you're like, all right, well, I guess, you know, you gotta have to make everything fit at that point.
Right.
So I try not to like change it too much, but if you gotta change it, you gotta change it.
You gotta let the story breathe and see where it goes, right?
Yeah.
So what have you found in regards to this time around writing a book from, I think you've had a pretty successful last couple of years.
Yeah, maybe.
And you've shown growth in your, I think, range of the things, the type of stories you tell, whether it's in the Cauldron short stories or whether it's in like stuff you've done, Black Hole Hunters, Deep Sea, and Happily Ever After. Is that what, that's the title of Happily Ever After? You got a good range there. So what have you found now, like, that you've learned in the process of creating and writing?
Well, I think, like, when I was younger, I was really trying to be, like, edgy and cool and be like, yeah, you know. Like, you read, like, a lot of Mark Miller stuff or Mark Millar or whatever.
Yeah, I don't...
And he was just like, yo, this is so edgy, this is so, like, you know. And so growing up, I'd read that kind of stuff and I'd be like, yeah, that's what I want. So then, you know, you just swear a lot, you have a lot of, like, weird stuff happen. But then as you mature, you're like, well, maybe I don't need that stuff. You know, maybe I can explore those same ideas, it's the same emotions, but in like a different way, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it becomes stronger, I think, if you can do that, you know what I mean? Because you don't need to swear all the time. But sometimes you do.
Yeah. Do you find that with the maturity, the work, you're taking more risks in what you're willing to try or to tell?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, when you... Because, like, writing is, like, you're putting yourself out there, right? And you're just, like, almost being, like, vulnerable as you do it. So having that maturity is, like, you can explore different things that you couldn't before. Because I know, like, before I would be, like, self-conscious, be like, well, I don't want to, like, you know, I'll just write something funny so that people aren't, like, you know, they're not weirded out or anything, but... Once you kind of mature, you can kind of, you know, you forget to do that and you just do whatever you want, right? And that's free and that's fun.
Right. So how do you feel this time around when you saw that issue number one of Undergrowth? I mean, it looks, I haven't seen a physical copy, but the digital looks really nice.
Yeah.
It looks like something that I could see on a comic shelf.
Hopefully one day.
But how do you feel about it?
No, it feels great, man. Like, especially like when you're working on the script and you're kind of like stuck on something and then the artist sends you like a page is like super wicked and you're like, oh yeah. So then it inspires you to do more, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole process on this was like, it's not different, but it's a lot easier, I find. Like, because me and him are kind of working on like almost on the same wavelength, you know what I mean? Like, he knows where I'm going with it. Because like I've written out the whole thing. There's nothing that's not written out. So he knows where it's going, and I know where it's going, and he's just like killing it on the art.
So how did you guys connect? What's the artist's name? Give him his just due, because he drew a beautiful book.
Daniele Aquilani, I believe. I probably like butchered that like crazy. But I found him on the internet. He was just posting. He's like, oh, I'm looking to do some work. And then originally I contacted him to do a different book. But then his stuff was, like, so sick that I was like, you know what, let's do his other book. And then he was down with it. So.
Where's he from?
He's from Italy.
So he's in Italy?
Yeah.
And how are you guys communicating? Does he speak
just
English?
He speaks English. Oh, okay, through, like, emails and stuff. And, like, we don't even talk that much. Like, every week he'll send me pages and that's it. And I'm like, yo, this is sick. And then,
that's awesome.
And then next week he'll send me more pages. Yeah, it works out pretty good, and he doesn't have any complaints, I guess, about the script, and his art is just, like, so good, as he said.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So.
That's sweet how, like, overseas, I guess, with the new... One good thing about technology is that we can connect.
Yeah, exactly.
When,
right?
When your computer's not messing up your podcast episode,
yeah.
You're able to connect with people overseas who... You speak the same language through art and words, even though it's, you know, different language separating
exactly
you. But his
right.
art is translating this story. Did he have any input in regards to like plot or where he sees the story going?
In terms of plot, not really. But the character designs that he did really influenced the story. You know what I mean? So like, I had the idea of like these four invaders coming in, but I didn't know what they did or where, or, you know, what they looked like. And then when he came up with the concepts, it kind of solidified. Like, what each one does and like what each one kind of represents and stuff. And then from there, I was able to like solidify like those characters, you know what I mean?
So your original vision for the book, did it, when you saw his art, did you say, that's the type of feel I want for this? Or did he draw it and create the world that made you say, I'm going to write now whatever I had to go with
it's
to
weird.
Complement
like, the
it.
Original idea, like, art style I had for it was, like, you know, that kind of, like, Steven Universe, like, really kind of, like, manga, like, really squish kind of characters kind of thing, you know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the original idea I had for it. But then when I saw his art, I was like, oh, that's sick. So then... So then I just asked him to do some art, and then he did it, and I was like, oh, yeah. And that kind of solidified in my head, like, what it looked like. And now what he's doing now is just, like, I can't picture it any other way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, would you look at that? The microphone finally kicked in, and everything sounds a lot more crisper.
Oh, man.
Shall we start from the beginning? No, I'm just kidding.
No, man.
All right. So we were talking about Daniele's... Yeah. Art style and how it helped influence where your story direction was going.
So his stuff, like when I first saw it, I was really drawn towards like his facial expressions and the way he drew like characters. And that's like, you know, that's like the most important part, you know what I mean? So I was like, well, if he could do that well, I'm sure he could do like, you know, robots well. Robots don't even have faces. So it turns out he can indeed kill it. So, and like backgrounds too, like, if you want to know if a comic artist is good, backgrounds.
Is that the tell?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, I don't know. Shane gets annoyed every time I point out issue 4 of Black Widow Hunters Club. I don't know what happened, but he, like, went off on backgrounds, and it was, like, so good. That's, like, the best issue we put out, issue 4.
So why does that upset him?
I don't know. Because I think he feels
it's a
like...
compliment.
He, yeah, but I think he feels like he gets better every issue, which is true. I mean, his storytelling gets better and, like, his art gets better. But there's something about issue 4. It's just like, I don't know, it's so good.
But I think that's typical. I don't think a lot of times the last issue is necessarily the best.
Yes.
It's the one that you hit the mark for every moment.
Yeah.
Like, you're in the groove, right? So
that's a good issue, man.
So issue 4, I'm gonna take a look at it again.
So if you look at your favorite comic artists and they're not drawing backgrounds, then are they your favorite?
You see, that's one of the things that I said about Jay Lee.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people love his art style, and I think he's got one of those styles that I want a poster of his work.
Right.
But when I see it in a book, I'm kind of like, it's very close.
Everything's
up.
Like very like misty all the time.
Yeah, there's definitely a feel to it.
But what's weird is he wasn't always like that. He was like more traditional, like when he was doing Beast and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he was like very like Marvel House style kind of guy.
Because he did Namor too, right?
Right. So I guess there's just, once he became comfortable with like, you know, his position in the industry, he's able to change. So it's not that he can't do backgrounds, it's just that that's his style.
Right. And you know who else I kind of felt like that a little bit with? And I really like his art and his stories for the books that he's working on now because I've gotten adjusted to it. But for a bit, Mike Del Mundo for me.
Oh, yeah?
Was
that's interesting.
It's I love his style, like his cover work. I want like all of his covers I want on my wall. But when I was reading like the Avengers, I couldn't follow where they necessarily were.
Are you too fancy?
there's that sort of that style that he's got. You know, it's definitely him. But the background part that I'm so used to, it helps me put things in position.
Yeah.
Where when I'm trying to follow the story, I was having a tough time with it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, like, it could be a combination of his style and, like, you know, the writer kind of writing really weird scenes, you know what I mean?
That too,
right?
I think the Thor book suits him perfectly.
Yeah, the Thor book's good. You should read his Elektra. He did an Elektra book.
Oh, really? Who did he do it with? But the art is what made it stand out.
Yeah, I don't even remember the art or the writer, but
screw the writer.
Yeah,
the writers are the worst.
Yeah, I don't even know who did it, but Elektra's dope.
So getting back to Undergrowth, how many issues do you have planned out for this, and are you going to put it in a collective format? Like, what's your plan for it?
So I have 6 issues planned, but it might go to 7 depending on how issue 6 goes, because I feel like I might be cramming too much stuff in issue 6. So we'll see. But also, too, it's like, you know, a money thing. Like, I'm not rich. I can't be paying this guy forever. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Which is, that's like, when you want to talk about writing, like, you, every page you write costs you money. You know what I mean? Like, if you're, right. if you're self-publishing.
Right, so I forget
like,
that.
Yeah, so sometimes you got to be like, is this page worth it? You know what I mean? But I don't know, usually it is. But yeah, so 6 issues, and then I want to release each issue as like a black and white single issue, and then color it and release a trade. At least that's the plan. But then I'm gonna like actually pursue publishers this time, because usually I don't, because I'm like scared. But now I'm like, yo, it's time.
What made your confidence get
to that? It's the artist. His art is like so dope that I'm like,
look at my artist.
Yeah, right.
I paid for these pages. Yeah, put them, exactly. Publish them.
So, and I think the story's pretty cool. And what's his name? When I first released like some previews, Jay Torres reached out to me and he's like, "Yo, this looks really good." And I was like, "Holy shit! Jay Torres says this is really good." I'm like, "All right, maybe there's something to this." You know what I mean? And then like I showed Adam Gorham, and he was like, "Yo, this is really good. I really like the story." And I was like, oh, "Okay." And then I showed Marcus Toe, and he's like, "Yo, it's really good." So I'm like, "All right, okay."
So you're getting good feedback from people you respect that would be honest with you.
Yeah, exactly, right? Well, I mean, as honest, like, you know, they probably
without
be
breaking
like,
you down.
Yeah, they probably wouldn't be like, "It's garbage."
But part of, I think, you hate using this term, but in comic books, you definitely judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, that's true.
And you think of some of like the ones that stand out on a shelf that aren't Marvel and DC, that are from an indie publisher or a creator-owned book, and the ones that I remember picking up, Paper Girls, strictly because of the way the cover was designed.
Those quick change, I
mean. Yeah, it felt like there was something different about them that made me be like, this, I want to pick up this book because it looks interesting. It looks right. like something to read. And I feel like Undergrowth, the way that the letters are designed, the whole look of it, kind of has that.
It's got a sweet cover. Right?
Yeah, it's got something that attracts yeah. your eye to be like, this might be worth it.
Yeah, no, the cover turned out really good. And, we had the cover made, and then I kind of contacted the logo artist to do the logo, Chris Johnson. And I was like, well, I kind of want to make it, like, big and in your face. So the logo is, like, huge. It's, like, maybe, like, 25% of the page, you know what I mean? And I think that works out pretty good. Like, I told him I wanted it to be, like, you found the Transformers logo in the jungle or something. And he's like, hey, you did a really good job.
Yeah, so. That's great. So you've been a pretty busy boy other than just Undergrowth. You've also launched the Cauldron book. I've had Shane on the show talking about that.
Cauldron.
But it's been nominated for a Schuster, the first issue. Is that correct?
Yes, Cauldron was nominated for a Schuster. And Happily Ever After. Super exciting, eh? So because Gene Day Award is for self-publishing, it's broken up into two sections. One is for anthologies and one is for, like, just regular books. Which I think is a genius move because anthologies are taking over, like, indie comics, and it's, like, getting to the point where, you know, you can't compete, man, because there's, like, 50 guys on a book. You can't compete with that. Anyway. But, yeah, so Cauldron's nominated for the Gene Day for anthology, and Happily Ever After is for the normal Gene Day, I guess. So that's pretty exciting stuff. I got two chances to win.
That's awesome, though. Like, think what would 12-year-old Ricky say, or early Maximum Carnage reading Ricky?
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yo, he'd be pretty stoked about that, man. Like, I think I posted this on Facebook. Like, when I first heard about the Gene Day or the Schuster Awards, I was like first getting into comics and like writing comics and stuff. And I was like, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna meet like comic people and I'm gonna start my career there. I didn't go because like I was like too scared or whatever. But now it's like I'm nominated for one, man. That's crazy.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's nuts.
That's gotta build up the confidence.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Yeah.
I mean, it's good when you have a little bit of either nomination or some hardware under your arm to be able to go somewhere and be like, hey, I've got something to show that
exactly,
quality,
right?
And I'm coming with it, right?
Yeah, so that's good. And then, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe I'll start submitting for Eisner's. You know?
Yeah. There you go.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, no, that's good. And then, like, right now I'm doing, there's Happily Ever After's in the PAMA Art Gallery, the Peel Art Museum and Archive. And so that's, like, pretty sick. It's up there. It's a regional gallery, you know. It's not just, like, a local hometown gallery. Like, this is, like, Brampton, Mississauga, Caledon, I believe. So that's, like, that's pretty sick.
That's great.
And then it was just in the newspaper in Brampton, the Brampton Guardian. So.
So when you started this endeavor of writing, what was the first thing that you did? Was it that 24-hour comic creation thing that you were there for?
No, it was Deep Sea, the 8 issues, or that was, the 8 pages.
That was the first thing you worked on.
It was only 8 pages.
Okay.
And we released that, and we sold, like, 100 in a day, and it was, like, crazy. So then, and then after that was the 24-hour comic day one, and then Black Hole Hunters Club
came out of that.
Yeah.
So when you started it all, did you have, you know, big dreams of one day writing for a publisher, or did you just want to make comics?
Yeah.
What was it for you?
Yeah, I just wanted to make comics, but then, yeah, in the back of my head, I was like, yeah, I know we're gonna, like, Marvel, DC, and some shit. But as you grow, and as you work towards, you know, what you thought was your goal, it kind of changes, you know what I mean? Now it's like, I don't know if I want to work for Marvel, DC. Like, I definitely would if they came knocking. I was like
yeah,
oh my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's not a measurement of success anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because you're like, well, I could do that, or I could do my own thing, you know what I mean? And your own thing is a little bit more rewarding than, you know, doing someone else's thing.
And, yeah, I was going to say, like, you could go on an established book or a character that people recognize or know, and you'll get some notoriety or attention, but do you feel that much more satisfaction when it's like, I created this,
this
is my idea from the ground up?
For sure, man. And it's like, a lot of people will see, you know, they'll be like, oh yeah, you write, you know, Spider-Man, but it's like, yeah, who cares about, like, not who cares about Spider-Man, but, like, you're not creating anything new at that point. You're just kind of adding
custodian,
he's putting it together, releasing something new. And then it's especially true now, like, where people are like, well, Spider-Man wouldn't do that, and you're like, alright, so what am I writing now, you know what I mean?
Spider-Man, like, shouldn't have money.
Yeah, right?
Spider-Man,
so, like,
shouldn't be married.
You're like, so can I change a character, can I do anything with it, or am I just telling the stories that, you know, I've already been told, just spice it up a little bit, you know what I mean?
And then you're just gonna hate it anyway.
Yeah, so it's like,
it's boring.
It's like, what do people want? What do people want?
Right.
So I'd rather do, like, create your own thing. And it's fun too to put together a book and, like, design it and everything, and, like, that's what I really like doing, is, like, making books, like, physical books. That's really fun. And it's like, some people out there, like, they're really successful, but they have no idea how to either put together a book, like, you know, or how to market a book. And it's like, well, you know, what's the point then? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you can't get it out into the world, if you can't make it, well, then what's the point of doing it?
That says a lot, though, about your work ethic, because you go to a fan expo or Toronto Comic Con or any of these cons. You've been to a bunch now.
Yeah.
Like, you've traveled around quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And everybody is trying to make a comic book.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And we've got the means, whether it's digitally, to put things together and just get it printed. But for people to garner some attention, for people to stop
it's
by,
tough,
and
man.
Especially for something that doesn't have, even at this point, a Dark Horse or an Image or a Boom imprint on it, and it's just your book.
Totally. And it's always so frustrating when you walk around, like, the pro section. You just have dudes sitting there, like, they don't have anything. Like, they got, like, some sketches on the table. You know, they don't have, and they're not engaging with anyone. And it's like, what are you, you're here for free, and you're not, like, you know, you're nothing. You're just sitting there. Like, so, I don't know. It gets kind of frustrating to see, like, pros who don't really, like, either don't care or don't, like, try anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's frustrating. I never want to be like that. Who knows? Maybe I will. Maybe I'll make $1 million and I'll be like, check
me
out.
Yeah, I was going to say, just lean back, be on my phone, and
let
them know, like, that costs that much. What do you want? You need a sign? Whatever. No.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I think you'll have the appreciation. I hope so. That you would keep that sort of... But you guys at your tables, you always are appreciative of friendly people coming. Like, yeah. That's just the people you are. You know, there's some pros that still appreciate, like, you go to Jim Zub's table, and he engages and is grateful for everybody who comes, even though he's writing Avengers or whatever the case may be. So I think you're either, you already think you're that person.
Yeah, that's true. There's definitely people in Artist Alley here, like, you know, sitting around doing nothing.
They already think they're the, you know. So, being a constant collaborator, because you can't, being a writer, you don't draw your own books yet.
No, right? Yeah,
you might one day. So you have to constantly find someone to collaborate with. What have you learned in the process of, like, every artist is different, from Shane to Dave Bishop to now Daniele. What have you learned in how you write and cater a story to them?
Well, I think even if I could draw, I don't think I would draw my own books. Like, no? I love the collaboration process. It's so good. And, like, because you'll write something, and then you'll be like, well, I don't know, this is kind of crappy. I don't like it. And then they'll draw it, and you're like, whoa, this is, like, pretty good. You know what I mean? Because they've added to it, and they've, you know, increased the value of it just through their work. You know what I mean?
Right.
So if you're really critical of yourself, and then they take it and make something sick, you're like, oh, yeah, okay.
We can make this work.
Exactly, right? So if it was just me on my own, I would, like, just crumple under the pressure. Like, nothing would ever be good enough, right? So.
Are you like, highly critical of yourself? Like,
I used to be. I learned to kind of, like, let it go. And that's through collaboration, because I'm like, well, I'll do this and then see what they come up with. And then if it's good, then we'll go with it. If it's bad, then we'll kind of readjust. Which, that's probably super annoying for collaborators who are like, you know, like, I don't want to readjust this or something or whatever, but yeah, I learned that, like, I'm really a big fan of collaboration. That's, like, my DNA.
Yeah. That's good. And, well, this is the perfect medium to be in, and I think for me as well, I appreciate bouncing the idea off of somebody. Like, I get inspired if ever I'm at, like, when me and my friend make a song.
Yeah.
He can, like, bounce some ideas at me.
Let's talk about that, man. What's the collaboration for that? Like,
but see, for me, I get very inspired when he says, this came to me, here's what I got. And then I'm able to come up with something to match that.
Yeah.
And it's not competitive. It's more like, you've inspired me, so I'm going to make what I do good.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if I do send it back to him, that back and forth inspiration, I think inspiration comes from collaboration.
Do you guys ever write bars for each other, or is it like you write all your stuff?
We write all of our own stuff, but there's times where we'll specifically write, like, if it's on my portion of the song, I'll maybe write something and be like, I want you to say that.
Okay.
Like, that's going to be you. That. So even, and back and forth, there's been, like, ad-libs or things where it's like, you're going to be the guy to say that because it'll sound better coming from you. So it really comes down to the one thing that I enjoy, good collaboration, you have to eliminate the ego.
Yeah, that's very important. That's true.
Right? So especially in something where, like what we do, it's always one-upping. Rap has always been like, who was better?
Yeah.
And that happens, and you never want to be the weakling. Yeah. Even when you're doing a comic book, right? You don't want to be like, I'll keep the art, you could get rid of the writer.
Yeah.
Because that sometimes happens too, right? I just had a conversation with a friend the other day where we were talking about the latest DC animated movie, Hush, came out. And we were talking about the story, and, you know, some people really love it. Some people are kind of like, the art's great. So he was like, you know, if you look at that story, what would you get rid of? You get rid of the writer, because it's all about how it looks.
I totally agree, yeah. Right? I don't think it's a good story.
See?
Yeah.
So you never want that to be the case, even in a collaboration.
That's true.
Because sometimes, like, writers always get top billing in comics. Like, it's Tom King's Batman, or it's Scott Snyder's Batman. But those stories are only as good as their artists, a lot of times, right?
So. Yeah, and I mean, as a writer, you kind of have to know that, you know what I mean? And you have to write to make your artists look good.
Yeah, so how did you adjust over, because I think your most frequent collaborator was Shane at first?
Yeah.
And now it's you've got, you know...
And these other guys,
You've done with Casey. And who was Keith Cottrell on The Last Cauldron? Was it Keith?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you've had a bunch of different people now, different styles.
Yeah, a lot of different styles. And that influenced the writing too, because as I'm writing, I'm like, well, what would look good in their style, you know what I mean? And
right.
That's the most important thing. So I can't really write something unless I know what the style is going to be, or I'll come up with an idea and then change it when I know what the style is like, going to be like. So, but yeah, it's like, I don't know, like when I read comics, I read it for the art, more or less. So I think,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, so for me, writing comics that way isn't as different because, like, that's the way I read comics, you know what I mean? Like, I was reading Chris Claremont's Dark Phoenix. It was driving me crazy, man. Like, I couldn't do it. Because, like, Chris Claremont, like, there'd be a scene where they, like, pull up in a car, and then there'll be a caption that says, they pull up in a car. And you're like, yeah, I know. I can see that. You know what I mean? It's so, like, it's too much words. I couldn't do it. So when I write comics, I'm really conscious of the amount of words I use, and I try to, like, minimize the amount of words I use, because it's so annoying to, like, have to read what you're looking at. You know what I mean? You're like, yeah, I have eyes, man, I know.
I think he's the most guilty of that verbose.
Too much, man.
Too much. Like, the story is great, but it's like, I don't need you to explain in poetry how Kitty Pryde is able to, like,
exactly,
walk through a wall and the ions of what she's able to do.
Yeah, right? You're like, what are you doing?
It amazes me when I, because I do a lot of, like, I read a lot of modern day comics, of course, but I really enjoy going back and getting the stuff that's collected that I never got a chance or was alive to read, right? And there's a lot of good art and storytelling in those. But I always wondered to myself, like, how did they go from issues that felt like there were almost like three issues in one to now you have this decompressed style where all you get all this information on you. In 5 minutes, you're done with the issue. Yeah. You get as much information. It's incredible. Like, how do you... Did you take any courses of like, comic workshop?
I took Ty Templeton's comic boot camp, the, like, writing one.
Okay.
I did that. There's, like, really great ideas in that, like, on story structure and stuff. But not necessarily, like, writing comics specifically. Like, it was more focused on, like, writing good stories, which is really great. But that whole, like, you know, how to tell, you know, one whole story in 24 pages wasn't really there. And that's something you can't teach, right? That's, like, your style.
Yeah.
And so you can't blame Ty Templeton for not trying to teach that, because, like, you just can't. You can't teach anyone how to write, like, dialogue and comics. You know, like, you can guide them, but you can't tell them how to do it.
Yeah.
So, and... So yeah, so I took that, but then other than that, man, like, it's just a whole lot of, like, watching TV and reading books and stuff, and reading comics, and then you really have to analyze what you read, too. Like, you can't just sit there and be like, all right, well, whatever, you know, you have to kind of, like, look at it and
see what's
how
working.
It works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been, as I've gotten older, I pay more attention to words that are chosen.
Yeah.
Sometimes in, like, maybe comic books or dialogue, it goes over your head because it's more of, like, it's a little bit more light. There's still a lot, depending on who the writer is, there's still a lot of, like, very choice words. But there's when you're reading things in, like, a newspaper or some sort of piece of literature or magazine that has an agenda, you're looking like, why did they use that word instead of
this one?
Exactly, right? Because it definitely, you can have two words that mean the same thing, but one makes you feel different.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, what kind of things did you notice in, like, all the things that you take in? What's some of the stuff that has, like, had the most effective on you?
Well, what I like to do, and what I think really influenced my writing is... I used to be in, like, high school plays and stuff when I was in high school. I used to do all the drama.
That's right.
And then when I graduated, my sister was teaching at my old high school, and she directed all the drama. So, like, for a good solid, like, 10 years, I was watching and performing in, like, high school amateur theater. And for some reason, I don't know why, but that's, like, that really influences my writing. It's weird to think of.
No,
like, it doesn't make any sense, man. But, like, the whole idea of, like, I don't know, when I write my dialogue, I hear it as if it's being performed at my old high school, It's weird.
It's not weird.
No, it's weird, man.
But you're basically a director in a lot of ways. Like, yeah. You and the artist are screenwriters and directors.
No, that's true. But it was never any good, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's like, and that's what inspires me, right? Is like, when you see something that's not very good, you get inspired because you're like, well, why isn't that good?
Right.
What would make it better? And, you know, what, because then when you do that, then you're like, all right, what works, what doesn't work? You know, you're really analyzing it, right? So, you know, all these high school performances, they are terrible, but at the same time, they're really great.
It's a learning curve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not to say, like, you know, my sister's directing's garbage, or, you know, the students are acting like garbage. It's just like, it's not like, you know, top-notch standards.
It's not Broadway.
Exactly. And so from there, it gives that room to improve. And then when you think about it, how you would improve it, and then you kind of get ideas from that, you know.
Right.
My sister's a great director.
So what have you found in regards to your dialogue? Because I'm always interested when I look at comic book credits. You've got a lot of times shared plotters. And then there's the artist, and then there's a scripter, but they're both plotters. So in regards to scripting and dialogue, where do you... I know you said that you think about it being performed, but where do you find the voice for, like, the characters that are in Undergrove? Do you have a place where you were in your head, like, they would speak like this? Do you grab it, let's say, from, like, a cartoon you remember?
No, you know what I think it is? I think it's music. I listen to music while I write.
Okay.
And I think that's where a lot of the... Yeah. Because I think... So when I start writing, I'll pick a soundtrack to go with it, and then I'll write to that music. So for Undergrowth, it was a lot of, like, Distillers. Like, so, like, not quite pop punk, but, like, punk music.
Right.
And that was kind of the rhythm I was going for, like, the ideas that I was going for with Undergrowth. But then it did actually evolve as the issues went on, and that... action kind of changed. Like, the beginning of Undergrowth, first three issues is, like, pretty action-packed, but then it kind of slows down in the middle, and then it's gonna ramp up again. So then the soundtrack actually changes too, so it became more like I get goth country music is kind of what came out. So there's this band, I can't even remember the name, doesn't matter, there's this band that, and they're like this, like, goth country music, and it's like, you know, not quite gospel music, not quite, like, bluegrass, but it's, like, really dark kind of... Like, you know, True Detective, the first season? The theme song for that? The Handsome Man family, or the Handsome Family or something? And so, so that's, like, the kind of vibe in the middle of the book. So I guess, like, a lot of the dialogue comes from music, you know, which is weird.
No, that makes perfect sense. Because I think... I don't think anything affects our mood more than sound.
Yeah, that's true.
That and maybe our scent. Because scent affects our like memory.
Yeah, that's
nostalgia.
True. Yeah.
But then when music is being played, it affects the way you're... Like, yesterday I was having dinner with my wife. This is a tangent. And I just had a Sevia soda. It has no sugar in it.
Okay.
And a plate of pasta with a salad. And we were playing Miles Davis, The Birth of the Cool. Because my wife really likes jazz.
Look at you guys. No,
my wife really likes jazz. Okay. And I give her the credit for that. So I'm listening to it. And we changed the record. We put on another jazz record. But I sat there, and it just hit me in the right spot.
Yeah.
Because of the lighting in the room and all that. I said, I kind of feel high. And I don't know what that feels like. Because I don't smoke weed or nothing. But I'm like... I got a buzz going.
Yeah, you just felt good, man.
You just felt good, but it was the music. So if you're writing to music...
Yeah, maybe your wife put some THC in that pasta. Who knows, man?
Who knows? But if you're saying that the tone of the dialogue is coming to you by listening to the music,
yeah,
it makes perfect sense because that will affect the mood of the reader. Like, I'll probably look up that music when I read the whole thing completely.
And then you can see it, you know what I mean? And then, like, too, like, the rhythm of the music kind of affects, you know, the dialogue and the rhythm of the dialogue, you know what I mean? So it's all kind of together. So if you really want to, like, if there's a moment that you really like, you just got to start smelling something and listening to music, you remember that moment forever, man. Like,
well, they say if you're selling a house, have baked cookies in the oven.
Okay.
And they say that, yeah, because in the process of looking for a condo, we went to one that was a potential winner, but it smelled like cat litter. And I couldn't, that was the cat litter apartment, right?
Shit, so they should have been baking cookies.
They should have been baking cookies, I'm telling you. I could have been living somewhere different. So you got this big commute now that you take, and it gives you your moments to read and refuel. Do you feel like when you are in the process of wanting to create something, you need to take in?
And that's where, like, you know, the crappy media comes in, right? Like, if I want to create something, I'll just start watching a bunch of stuff and then that'll inspire me. So, like, with Undergrowth, with Gundam and, like, those other mech animes and stuff, you just watch it and you're like, oh, yeah, now I'm inspired to do something. And, I mean, it could, sometimes it's derivative and it's like, oh, yeah, clearly this is where you got it from. But if you're good enough, you can change it up a little bit. You know?
Yeah, but it, that's the point, right, is that Batman, if I'm reading Batman and I want to read, and I want to go to Marvel, and I don't want to read Batman no more, but I want to go to Marvel and get a Batman feel, got Daredevil.
Yeah.
Like, they're similar, but they're different enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So I don't think anybody has a problem with things being like, if you like this, you'll like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like those derivative things, just as long as it's not a straight up knockoff.
And if it's too similar, sometimes people are like,
right? But like, what is, do you watch Stranger Things?
I've seen the first season, not the second.
Not the second. Did you like it?
Yeah, the first season was good.
What does it remind you of?
I don't know, like Goonies.
Exactly, yeah. Right? But it's not the Goonies.
Yeah.
But it gives you that feeling again.
So
right?
Then what does the Goonies remind you of? Is that completely original and new idea?
No, the Goonies reminds me of Indiana Jones for kids.
Okay, yeah.
That's what I thought of it as.
And then Indiana Jones is like the classic, like, 50s kind of explore things.
It's kind of like, I think Indiana Jones has that same feel of the James Bond.
Okay.
But in the 40s.
In with archaeology.
Yeah, because I think, well, George Lucas had said that he wanted to either do Indiana Jones or Star Wars. It was a toss-up. Star Wars happened first, but then Steven Spielberg was like, I really want to direct a James Bond. He goes, I got something better.
Oh, really?
So that was Steven Spielberg's, like, answer to getting the James Bond thing out of him, was to do Indiana Jones, right? Like The Mummy. I like The Mummy because it reminded me of Indiana Jones.
The Mummy, the Brendan Fraser one?
Yeah. It reminded me of that.
Like, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So we like those things that take us back, but they're different enough where they stand on their own, right?
Yeah. So Undergrowth is like those things, but
completely different.
Totally different.
Has a little bit of consciousness to it.
There you go. Yeah.
I found your story for in Cauldron, the I can't remember the title now. Cauldron 2.
Okay, The Encroaching War.
The Encroaching War. Yeah. I was thinking of the word. It starts with an E. I'm like, what did it start? Not the Awakening War. No, the Encroaching War. It had a message to it. Yeah.
That one was interesting because Keith had plotted it out.
Oh, okay.
It was crazy, man. Keith gave me an 11-page, like, plot, man. The book's only, like, I think it's like 10 pages. And Keith's plot is like 11 pages. I was like, whoa, man, relax. but it turned out pretty good. And so Keith had this idea, like, he wanted to, so he kind of plotted it along with me, like, he and him talked about it. So that one was, the whole process was a lot different than every other book I've done. So yeah, so there's a pretty clear message to it. But I think that comes from Keith, you know what I mean? Not to say that I'm not, like, I don't put messages in my books, but at the same time, like, a lot of it was, like, Keith had this plot that he was going towards, and I was, like, helping him facilitate that.
So how do you, there's got to be a bit of a challenge when you go from having all the space in, like, a 24-page story to now you're telling a pretty complete story in 11 or 10 pages inside of it. Is it?
Yeah, man. Like the, I forgot what it was. I think it was the Toronto Comics Anthology. They gave me like 8 pages, I think it was. And I was like, oh my God, this is so hard. Because like you gotta tell this, like, you know, a worthwhile story in 8 pages, you know. And it's not like, you know, 8 page written, like prose story. It's a lot of words in it. But like with comic, you're working with maybe like, you know, 50 panels at the most. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's tough, man. I don't know how to do it.
But that must have been able to inform you, like being able to be succinct in your storytelling but clear. Yeah. That's got to be such a good learning curve to be able to slim it down, and then when you want to expand it, you know where to kind of trim and
yeah, no, tuck stuff. That's true. And like by being able to write in like smaller spaces, you can create more like impact in the longer ones, because it's like they're short and succinct, but like there's more of it, more like little jabs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a real talent, man. Like to be able to write short stories. I'm okay at it, but you know, I'm not like amazing at it.
You're doing it though. That's
trying
the key, right?
Trying to.
You're exercising the muscle.
Yeah, yeah.
So
always gotta improve, man.
So if you win the Schuster, if you go 2 for 2, what do you do? What do you do to celebrate?
I think I go to Disneyland and I don't know.
You gotta do something. That's pretty special, man.
I don't know, man. I don't do much, man. I just hang out. I don't like party.
I mean, no one says you gotta party and go do like an 8-ball. But like, what would you buy yourself something to commemorate it, like to celebrate it? Like, hey, this was this memorable thing.
I don't know. I'd probably like, you know, have like a barbecue or something.
Chips would you have to celebrate? Would you go up to the stage, accept your award? What bag of chips would you have?
It'd be probably like, I think right now I'm feeling Miss Vicky's salt and vinegar, the malt vinegar. I bring that stuff up there. But then the party, that's where you get crazy, right? You get the party mix. You get some Doritos in there, some Ringaloos. That's the party flavor.
They gotta go to Gotham Central.
Yeah,
and
that
candy store
candy.
They have the James Harden gummies.
Like, why? Jeez.
That's hilarious.
Speaking of basketball,
okay.
You got a Raptors hat on.
Yes.
Are you sad that Kawhi's gone, or are you okay with it?
Man, that's... I was on a bit of a tirade when the news broke,
because
I was happy that he didn't go to the Lakers. And I grew up a Lakers fan. I'm a Kobe Bryant guy. I named my dog Kobe and everything. But I didn't like the super team creation that they were trying to do. I'm not for that. So I'm like, I really hope he stays here, first of all, because as much as for everything he did for us, I think we did a lot for him.
Yeah.
In restoring his reputation.
His brand, yeah, man.
His brand, yeah. We definitely gave him the canvas to do that, and I don't think it was like, oh, wow, we owe him everything, erect a statue.
Yeah, no. Like when they're like retired jerseys,
no.
It's like, are you crazy?
No, yeah. If he played here maybe 3 to 4 seasons, I'd say for sure. But when he went to the Clippers, when I'm like, I was sad, I'm like, oh, well, he went home, he went to the Clippers, it's not LA, okay. Then as time wore on, I got pissed. I felt pissed off. Because it was confusing. I'm like, what I felt was like, as a Torontonian, like the older I've gotten, I've become more like at city pride. I really love my city, but I hate how in certain sports we're always like anywhere but Toronto.
Yeah, I hear you.
And so I'm like, it made our city look stupid because we won the championship.
Yeah, and then he left anyways.
I'm like, nobody does that.
Yeah.
Because the whole team is still here. You stay, we're defending champs, and we're the team to beat.
Yeah.
And you leave, and like, everybody's left in a flux.
I agree, man. It's like, it's pretty bullshit, man.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah, and then what rubs me the wrong way is that he's still going around in like Raptors gear. Like, take it off. Take off the Raptors gear. Go play for your Clippers. You know, all the best to you.
Yeah.
I hope you lose to the Lakers. Yeah, because, man, like, we had one of the best playoff runs. He had an amazing playoff. Our team had an amazing story. An amazing parade.
And it kind of took away from the celebration. Like, no one's talking about the championship anymore.
No.
They're all like, oh, yeah, he left. And you're like, yeah, but we're still the champion. Like,
we're still,
you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, it doesn't feel like, you know, a championship.
It diminished it.
Yeah.
It definitely diminished it. So, yeah, I had Raptor fever for sure. I have my... I'm still waiting for my championship hat to come in. I didn't get the the one that says championship on it. I just got the logo with the little trophy on the side, okay. So it like doesn't age as bad. Did you ever notice like people who are wearing like Blue Jays 1993?
Yeah. You're like, get a life.
It's like, still got that shirt? But anyways, yeah, it hurt. It soured me a little bit. Because, like, what do we have to fill that spot now?
Yo, Siakam, man. He's gonna...
I hope so. I really hope so. But I liked... You know what? I liked the guy. I really liked Kawhi because he wasn't selfish. He didn't beat his chest after, like, he had a big play. It was very much team-centric.
Yeah.
And I love that. It was such a difference in character.
Yeah,
but...
He'll regret it. He'll see.
I hope so. And then he's going to win a championship again. And,
nah, man.
He got the last laugh. So, what are you reading these days? Your commute?
Yeah, so the biggest book I'm reading is that new X-Men relaunch, House of X and Powers of Ten or whatever.
Are you a Hickman fan?
No.
No.
Okay. I don't think I read anything by Hickman that I was like, oh, he's so confusing all the time, man. Like, his stuff is... Like, his Avengers run before he left Marvel was like, what the hell's going on? Like, that ex-Nilo guy.
Did you read it?
I tried. I didn't know what was going on.
I just read it this year. Like, incomplete. Like, from beginning to end. That with New Avengers. Yeah. I did it all. Even Infinity.
It's good?
You're right.
It's confusing. It doesn't make any sense.
The ex-Nilo thing was very confusing for me because I never felt it was explained exactly who he was, where he came from. It just became this character that was there. And I really liked the big concept aspect of it. That was cool. It was very... As the story went on near the end of that Before Time Runs Out, there was like a story where Cap was going back in time that was cool. I like time travel stuff. And The Time Runs Out, I felt was more clear of where they were going with it.
Okay.
When they were getting close to the final incursion. But what it really felt like was a really prolonged Crisis on Infinite Earths. That's what it was.
Right.
Did you read the New Avengers with the Illuminati? You'd like that one maybe because there's a lot more character development and dialogue, less action, but more like of the morality of we're the smartest men in the 616,
right.
And we realize that these universes are colliding with each other. Should we save our universe at any cost, or do we become? Are we good or are we malevolent by destroying the universe colliding with us? Because we're killing billions, right. Essentially. Yeah. Like within the group, there's Namor and Black Panther, both their kingdoms are at each other's necks, but they're in this secret society where they can't let each side know what's actually happening.
Yeah.
So that behind the scenes of that was really good.
Like, Jonathan Hickman can be good. I'm pretty sure I read some stuff that I've liked.
Did you like read Manhattan Project, East of West? I tried East of West because I heard it was the greatest thing ever. I was confused.
It's confusing.
I was confused.
He's like a less cool Grant Morrison. Where like Grant Morrison's confusing, but at the same time you're like, yo, all this stuff's crazy and it's like, what the hell's going on? But it's like really cool. Whereas Jonathan Hickman is like, you're confused, but at the same time you're like, it's kind of boring. Like, it's not that exciting.
His Fantastic Four was really good.
Yeah,
that was really cool. And that is part of his whole Marvel run. It's all connected from the time he's doing Fantastic Four into Avengers, into Secret War. It all, like, comes together. But it's a commitment. And for a lot of people who enjoy story, they're like, give me 12 issues that I can live with and reread. And it's like, I want the complete story.
That's why, like, I always love, like, the Marvel Now stuff is so good because, like, they were short and concise and, like, you know, it was clear that they weren't trying to tell these huge stories, and like every single Marvel Now book was like sick. Everyone.
What was the big event that kind of was the relaunch of Marvel? Avengers vs. X-Men.
Yeah.
I think that's the first Marvel Now, and then they had like the Marvel Now with the exclamation point.
Oh yeah.
Like, Marvel Now. I thought a lot of their books were really good.
Yeah. 2013 Marvel killed it.
Whatever your taste was, I defy someone to be like, Marvel sucks. Okay, you don't like X-Men? This Thor from Jason Aaron is amazing.
So good.
Right?
And then Moon Knight was fantastic.
You got the Moon Knight. That was good. The Daredevil with Mark Wade was good.
Good. I don't know what it was. They killed it.
I like all their books. Like, I'm going back and retroactively, like, reading stuff that I missed. And I'm like, man, DC had, like, this bump with the New 52 just because they restarted the universe. But, like, looking back, maybe 5 or 6 books hold up.
Yeah.
Overall, line-wise. But, like, Marvel, everything. And what I like about the way Marvel has, like, these segments, or I don't know what the proper terminology is, but you don't got... I was just saying this to another podcaster, Adam Chapman. It's like, if you want to read Heroes Reborn era Marvel, and it still will kind of count, and this Thor, if you read that, it'll still inform you to some extent, but you don't need it.
Yeah.
Or you can read it all and it's just meaningful, or just skip, like, you don't gotta read Grant Morrison X-Men in order to enjoy Astonishing X-Men
from reading. But it helps.
It helps. But it'll make one will make you want to read the other.
Right.
Whereas, like, I find with DC, it's this is good, but now it doesn't count anymore. Like, Grant Morrison's Superman is like...
Yeah, that's true.
It was maybe would have been cool, but what they ended up doing is, like, it doesn't even matter if you read that. Right?
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
a small blip. But, so, Power of X or Power of Pen or House of X,
yeah.
what are you thinking of this Hickman stuff?
So far, I'm digging it. I think the direction he's taking the X-Men is pretty cool. It's kind of pissing me off that he's got these, like, organic technology thing, because that's like undergrowth, and I'm like yo man, what the hell, man, like, that sucks. But maybe that just gets people interested in, like, organic technology, and then undergrowth comes and they're like, oh,
well, what no one can accuse you of is copying it.
Yeah, that's true,
because you're releasing it at the same time. So
yeah.
It's not like this is, I like that,
that's
so I thought
true.
I'd do, like, there's no way for you to have been able to copy
that's
it
true.
So,
but yeah, it's so far, it's been good. I was reading that, like, apparently there's, like, an X-Men story before this where was it Krakoa, those plants, like, are cloning X-Men, and, like, so these X-Men aren't actually, like, the X-Men. They're just the clones from the plants. And I was like, well, that's, like, some pretty important information that, like, has appeared in some obscure, like, you know, X-Men book.
Were you reading any X-Men stuff before this?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah, me neither.
And, I just recently started getting into X-Men because of this. So I'm, like, reading, you know, like, Dark Phoenix. And I read Rick Remender's X-Force run.
That was
really good.
That was really good.
Yeah. Although, like, sometimes Rick Remender, the way he writes is like, look at this wacky world. Look how crazy it is. And you're like, all right. And he's like, whoa, look at that. And you're like, okay, like, what else? And he's like, well, look how crazy everything is. And you're like, all right, well, there's nothing else. Like, you know, like, with the X-Force, you had, like, the world, that thing that, like, Phantom X, like, lived in, or that, like, computer-made world, you know what I mean? And then you had, like, the weird and wacky world of Captain Britain, and then you had the weird and wacky world of Age of Apocalypse, and that's it, man. It's just, like, wacky world after wacky world.
Certain guys have their shtick of,
yeah.
like, their go-to. I don't know if you read Black Science at all.
No, but I bet that's, like, a wacky world, you know what I mean?
It's dimension hopping. It's what's cool about that is you can kind of see with certain writers where their heart's at, or where their psychology
yeah.
is at. Like, you look at a Tom King, and he clearly, like, loves his wife. All of the stories.
Oh, that's beautiful, man.
No, yeah, and
wow.
he's admitted it. He's admitted it, but when you read it, it's like Vision is a family story.
That's
and then
funny,
Mr.
Yeah.
Miracle is
yeah.
is the relationship between Barda and, I don't know if you read Mr. Miracle.
No,
yeah. So good.
Is it because you love your wife too, and it's like,
yeah, no, yeah, I do, but
you relate to it.
I think Tom King tells those very good 12 issue.
Oh, that's interesting.
Stories.
I never even thought about
and
that.
And then he spent, you know, all this time with Batman and Catwoman.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So he's very much into the dynamic of relationship
interesting.
In some capacity. And then you got Remender, who I think I had heard him say on a number of podcasts where he had, like, a pretty he was kind of a messed up kid, like in his teens. So like Deadly Class is very much like that high school rebellious. He was like a rebel kid in high school. I think he was like a drug dealer or something like that. Like,
yeah, and I mean, I'm not saying that it's bad or anything. Like, that's his thing.
It's
like
you
can look at my work and be like, oh yeah, this guy got his thing of like plants. I don't know. Like, I haven't analyzed my work.
I think so far between Deep Sea and this one, you've got definite consciousness about the planet, like the concern of like it being taken care of.
Yeah, and I think there's a the idea of like people not doing stuff. Inaction becomes action in my books. There's a lot of that. So, but yeah, I mean, like Rick Remender, like that whole X-Force run was like wicked. But it's just funny to see, like, man, what wacky world are we gonna go to next? You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, no, and Black Science is like, it's a person who has the ability, what he wants to do, it's a cool book, actually, and there's sometimes, like, you can see, like, this was someone's therapy session, what they write in dialogue, it's like, man, that's profound, but you must have, like, just come to that moment of clarity in your life to want to share that, but it's about a scientist whose personal life is a mess, but he's discovered a way to dimension hop, like through the multiverse. Okay. But what he wants to do is take his crew of scientists, go to the dimension where they've cured cancer, cured these things, bring it back, and make where they're from a better place. But in the process, something goes wrong with the machine that transports them. So what they end up doing is just trying to find their way back home.
Oh, okay.
But his kids are stuck with him. So each place has a version of them of some kind. And they've just got to take whatever they can to survive the next dimension hop. So it's cool in that way, and there's like the morality tale of growth as a person. But again, it's that thing of wacky world after wacky world.
He's like, man, he should like devise his own like theme parks. I think to be great at that.
Yeah. So what did you think of the bombshell of Moira MacTaggert?
I thought it was cool. I like the idea of it, that she's like reincarnated all the time and stuff. And I like, what was it, like Destiny or whatever?
Yeah.
Where it was like, yo, I'll just kill you in every single life. Like, you know, it's not a big deal. And I was like, oh, that's pretty sick. But other than that, like, I don't know. It kind of seemed like, so like, are we saying that like every timeline is like the same? Like, I don't know. I'm a little confused of what it means exactly.
So, but she's, from what I understood, because I actually talked about this on my very last episode, I read the comic in between our recording, because I hadn't read it yet. We paused, I read it, and then we talked about it right away. So if I understand correctly, she's lived these alternate versions, and the X-Men that you're reading retroactively of, you know, Phoenix, Dark Phoenix, and what we know as the X-Men is her current life that she's been living. We've never known about the other one. So this whole time, she's been a mutant, and this whole time, Xavier has known what the other outcomes would be. And this is potentially her last life to try to make the proper change, because she's failed already 10 times.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So it brings into question, like, the destiny, free will. Is there anything that you can do to change the eventual outcome?
Well, but clearly there is something you can do to change the outcome, because she changes it 10 times.
She changes it, but she's never succeeded in her goal, because she's tried to end mutant kind and it didn't work. And she tried to kill all of the Trasks.
And she joins Magneto. Apocalypse,
right?
And Magneto.
Yeah, yeah, all of those times. It never actually turns out. So when she meets Xavier in our 616 that we consider, you know, reality, the whole time he's known these outcomes.
Which makes you, he, like, looked in her head,
because
right?
she let him read her mind back in whatever it would have been. So the whole time you're reading Dark Phoenix Saga, Xavier knows of other alternates of how this has happened already. It messes with you when you think of, like...
No, because that... Because, like, so within the book, there was, like, one timeline that was, like, the Dark Phoenix stuff, right? And then she dies, and then there's a new timeline. So the Professor X now, with the helmet, knows all those outcomes, but the Professor X before didn't.
He did. How? Because this 10th timeline is the one that we know of everything that's happened in, like, 616.
Right.
So it's been, you know...
But is it... So this is... That's...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's what it's insinuating. So the whole history of the X-Men, Xavier has known of these alternate versions of reality that Moira has lived through because she's got this immortal reoccurring spirit.
What?
So he's made all of his decisions with that information. So whatever, you know, the...
No, but... Because the timeline we're in now, where he read her mind, is the timeline where he puts on the helmet with the plants and everything. Like, the House of X, right?
Yeah, but that's a flashback.
What, the helmet and the... Yeah.
Her, him meeting her...
Right.
...takes place before the X-Men are formed.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Okay.
So...
But then, this timeline, he puts on the helmet with the plants and everything.
No, this is a resurrected Xavier. He's come back to life. Because remember, he died in Avengers vs. X-Men. He hasn't been around. He's been come back in Phantom what? X's body.
Alright, I don't know. So, I don't know what's going on.
did you read any of the X-Men during, like, Bendis run?
No.
When, like, after Avengers vs. X-Men...
No, I didn't.
Cyclops is basically, like, him and Magneto are on the same side now.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
And when the young X-Men... come to the future,
yeah,
to try,
okay,
to stop.
I read that, yeah.
So this isn't a new timeline. This is the same X-Men
timeline.
That's
the same one?
It's all the same timeline.
Because, oh, okay,
if you look at... Did you see the issue itself?
Yeah.
It has that, like... It has that graphic design that he has, and it goes through all of these things.
Yeah.
Of what's happened in each.
Oh,
and
okay,
where it diverges. So if you look at the 10th one and read, like, all the little things, it's like, oh yeah, that happened here. Oh, there's the Kenny X-Force.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there's that.
And that's the timeline we're in now.
That's the timeline,
oh,
we think we know.
All right.
So it makes you be like, what? Yeah. So we'll see. Hopefully he sticks the landing.
Jeez. We'll see. Yeah, no, I'm excited for the direction that X-Men going. I think it's cool.
It's good that they have a definite direction, because it just felt like, I think a lot of it had to do with the property being Fox.
Yeah.
That Avengers are now the it thing, and don't be too creative with the X-Men.
Yeah.
They just...
As much as Marvel doesn't want to admit it, it's most likely that.
I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
They were kind of getting... Like, I don't know if any of the stories were good, because it just seemed to reboot.
Yeah.
No one had their run. I heard Matthew Rosenberg was doing some cool stuff, but I didn't read it.
Yeah. But then he just started killing everyone because they knew they were going to reboot it. So he's like, yeah, just kill everybody.
Right? So now this is happening. Anything else that you, like, are enjoying?
There's that new Absolute Carnage book. I'm, like, halfway through that. But, like, Donny Cates been doing, like, he did, like, all his Venom stuff is, like, they're all connected. And they're, like, pretty cool so far, you know?
He did the Venom with that started with Stegman, right?
I think so. And then he did, like, now he's doing that Carnage stuff, and then Silver Surfer Black. And Silver Surfer Black, man, like, Chad Moore's art, I don't know what happened, but he went Super Saiyan, and, like, this stuff's, like, so cool.
Yeah.
All his art is, like, so sick in that book.
I can't wait to collect that, because I'm a trade waiter.
Man,
you don't like that.
No, whatever. But.
I wonder if that is bothersome to a comic shop, or because they gotta. It's such an interesting industry where they gotta, like, see what people are gonna buy weekly,
yeah,
and then what people are gonna collect. I just find the space wise.
Yeah, and, like, having it collected is a little bit better.
It's nice. It's a good. Like, I feel like, oh, that's the whole story.
Yeah, right? I agree.
So. I'm really looking forward to reading that Silver Surfer, because I've developed quite an affinity for the character after the Dan Slott run. Did you read that?
I did. It was okay. I wasn't like...
Did you finish it?
I think so.
Maybe. For me, the way it finished was, like, mind-blowing.
When I was reading it, it read more like a kind of, like a fantasy of, like, oh, yeah, if I had a girlfriend in space, this is what we would do. You know what I mean? And it just, for me, when I was reading it, I'm like, okay, enough with the fantasy of, like, you know, dating in space. I get it.
Yeah, it was very Doctor Who-esque.
Yeah, and it just felt like it was fulfilling some kind of, like, fantasy.
Of Dan Slott's?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't want to accuse Dan Slott of anything. But it just felt like I was... It felt too personal, maybe, for me. You know what I mean?
Okay.
It felt too, like, romantic and too personal.
Oh, okay.
But I was like, oh, whatever.
You want a little bit
and, like,
more.
And the female, I can't remember what her name is.
Dawn.
Yeah, something like that. She was just too perfect. You know what I mean? She was, like, didn't have any faults. Didn't have any, like, nothing bad ever happened. And she just saved the world, like, all the time.
But yeah. I'd be interested if you did finish the book, if you feel like you finished the run, and you felt that way, like, I get it. But I also feel like maybe you didn't finish it.
Maybe I did.
Just because, but I think what you're describing kind of fits also the experience, because it was very much, it was very emotional. It was very, had a lot of heart to it. Like, the ending of how it kind of wraps up the lifetime that they've lived, I don't know if you got to that part. Because it did 15 issues and then relaunched and then another 14 or 15. I thought it ended really, really well.
I'll have to go back checking it.
Yeah, maybe it'll still stay that way. But I've developed, like, I enjoy the cosmic arena of Marvel.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool.
Sometimes I don't understand it. Like, I don't get all of the pseudoscience, but I love it. Anything from other publishers?
I mean, there's some indie books I'm reading, I just can't remember what they are. Oh, I just finished Little Bird. I thought that was dope. Little Bird is, I don't know who published it, I forgot. But, it's like, it takes place, like, in Canada, and it's got, like, this, like, big, burly Canadian guy who, like, can't be killed, or, like, he can't take damage or whatever, and then he's got to save, Canada, something like that. I can't remember. But there's a lot of Canada in it.
So it's good.
Yeah, it's just good. And then there's, like, a church and stuff, and the art is, like, so good.
Yeah. So Fan Expo's coming in a week.
On a week.
Where can the people find you at Fan Expo and pick up Underworld?
I don't know my table number, but they can come find me. I think I'm labeled under the Lime Press banner, so they can look in the program for Lime Press. I'll be posting where I am on Facebook and stuff, so you can just follow me there. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty excited with Fan Expo. I think it's going to be good. Yeah. Me and Tishon Dwyer have a table together. You know Tishon?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're splitting the table. He's got a new book, too, for his Desert Messiah.
Okay. Top notch.
Yeah, yeah. I edited it, quotation marks.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. So how much is Underworld going for?
$5. I don't want to charge more than $5 for comics.
And you know what? That's how much a lot of these Marvel comics are going for are not as good as maybe House of X is.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be it's a worthwhile purchase to get Underworld number one.
So as
first
as
printing.
First. Well, there's a preview issue before that, but...
But not a complete...
Yeah, exactly. Not complete.
Right?
Yeah,
it's not the Free Comic Book Day issue.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I can start calling it. The Free Comic Book Day issue.
Yeah.
And then there's the full issue.
So what's the schedule going to look like for the rest of the releases for Underworld?
It's probably all going to be, like, related to, like, cons and stuff. So, like, issue one will be Fan Expo. Issue two will probably be maybe Halloween.
Okay.
And then issue three, probably March Comic Con.
Okay. So how far along are you, or is...
We're actually almost done issue two. We got like
Perfect. Six
or seven more pages.
Perfect.
Yeah. So.
That's great.
And then I'm almost done writing issue five. And then, so I'm almost done writing. And then he's like, you know, he's
good
got
a pace.
I think so. Yeah, it's a good pace, but my wallet's kind of... tell me slow down, but
it'll all come back.
Yeah,
though.
Exactly.
You know, because once people see that, I think the biggest trepidation when you go to an artist alley is if I buy this for $5-$10 and it's one issue, like, you want to support these guys, but am I gonna get the full story?
Yeah, exactly.
So if you've got that full story, it'll be like Black Hole Hunters. You'll have this good looking book on your table that people
will be
interested in.
So yeah, that's really what I do all the work for, is to have those sick books on the table. You know what I mean? Like, because when you put out all the books, you're like, whoa, look at all these books I've done.
Yeah, it makes the person that's selling you this stuff like, oh, you're not just selling me this little pamphlet. Yeah. Like, you got a book.
Exactly.
Makes a difference.
That's what I want, man.
It's good. It was good to catch up. We got to do this more often.
Yeah, I got to be like Shane too, and like
screw Shane.
Yeah, screw that guy.
We're gonna have the Portuguese prince.
There you go.
Well, thank you for coming back. It's been a blast, and I'm gonna look for you next week at Fan Expo. And should we get some dessert?
I think we should.
All right, sounds good. Thank you everybody for listening. You can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on Facebook. And leave us a review on iTunes. It's always helpful when people leave a review. It helps get the show out there for more people to listen. And make sure you get a copy of Undergrowth any way that you can. Follow Ricky Lima. Where can they follow you?
They can follow me on Instagram at king.k.rule. Twitter is king.k.rule. Facebook is Ricky Lima. I don't think there's anything else. Is there? I got LinkedIn.
I think we need a Portuguese prince.
Like a Twitter Portuguese
prince. Has it stuck at all?
Nah, man. No one else calls me Portuguese prince. Sometimes Shane does.
Yeah.
All right, I'll do an imprint of Line Press called Portuguese Prince. And it's like, I don't know.
The Portal Prince.
Yeah.
Right?
And it just publishes like Portuguese comics. I don't know.
We gotta make it stick.
All right.
Thank you everybody for listening. Stay tuned for more episodes from the Cave of Solitude. We will talk to you soon.
Yeah.